That the physical structure of these pores is actually where the action is. And I think that the way water and pores connect the soil and different islands of resources and microorganisms is really critical to understand for understanding what drives behaviors that we're observing in soil. So the spatial separation of carbon microbes and enzymes is a really important mechanism of soil carbon protection. And when soils are saturated, all of the pore channels fill with water. And this is actually using water as a conduit. Oh, this is going to be a pain in the butt. Water is kind of a conduit. I think of it as a hydrologic highway that allows resources to move through the soil, to diffuse, to transport, to be drawn through chemotaxis and whatever. I also think that if there's going to be any opportunity for microbial motility, that this is going to happen when soils are saturated rather than them being fixed. But if soils dry, hydrologic connectivity is really diminished strongly. And as we know, one of the major hypotheses that drives why we have soils, such high diversity in soils, is in these field moist soils, it is really strongly speculated that we get little resource islands where the microbes actually evolve kind of independently, and that leads to this really diverse community that we have. But water isn't just this conduit. Water is also the chemical solvent that all of these reactions occur in. And when soils are saturated, solutes are really relatively dilute. And one of the things I'll go into in a moment is how this affects what kind of carbon is rendered available. Because as soils dry, here we go again, as soils dry, the solutes concentrate in water films and the micron scale ionic strength increases. And some of the work that's been done looking particularly at things like uranium transformations that have been studied at PNNL, we can see that this ionic strength can change like 9 orders of magnitude within micron scale. And under these conditions, we get some very different chemical reactions happening. This is a paper that was led out of PNNL by some material scientists who were really interested in looking at how much energy does it take to rip a model compound off a clay surface. And what they did is they were using dynamic force microscopy. They were using dynamic force microscopy, and they used several model compounds, adhered them to clays, and then measured the disruption forces needed to rip them off. And one of the things we found is when soils are relatively dilute, simpler compounds were easier to come off, and it was the more complex carbons that stuck more firmly. When we increase the ionic strength, something more consistent when soils are really, really dry and the solutes are super concentrated, the energy of desorption release favors the release of complex compounds over the simpler compounds. So, is there a way we can take this understanding of surface, sort of pore scale dynamics, and use that to understand what we see when we're studying, say, core scale or field scale CO2 and methane emissions? Well, we did an experiment, and Peyton Smith has been working really closely with me on this. In fact, this was kind of her baby, where we're looking at what happened when we compared soils that have been subjected to drought to those that have been simulated, flooded. And if we incubated these for extended periods of time under these conditions, what happened to the CO2 fluxes? And one of the things we found was that drought, when followed by wetting, the experience of drought in a soil basically overshadowed every other effect we could possibly have in governing CO2 losses. We found CO2 rates were higher in drought-induced cores, whether we wet them through simulated precipitation or whether they were saturated through simulated groundwater rise. And there was a small difference here, but that was something I'm not going to go into for this. So we wanted to really understand how these spatial and hydrologic drivers of carbon destabilization link to mechanisms. This idea of what's the quality of carbon coming off, how is water behaving as a solvent for reactions, and how is it behaving as a solution phase that connects these soils, these soil pores. So we've developed an approach in our lab where we're using controlled suctions to selectively sample pore waters from different size domains. Now, this is imperfect. I mean, we could have a huge discussion on all the failure points on this, but it has been a way for us to move forward with a more spatial understanding of the quality of carbon and the reactions that are going on in these soil pores. So depending on how we set the suction, we initially pull off pore waters from larger pores, roughly 150 microns in diameter. And then by increasing the water tension, we can go up to very fine micropores, down as low as 3 microns in diameter, but we're going to focus here sort of in the 6 to 20 range for our fine pores. And when we've done this research, when we've done these experiments, looking at a very sandy soil, believe it or not, soil that has about 92% sand, we actually find more complex carbon compounds dominating the fine pores. And by this, let's be specific, I will use the lazy person's term, complex, but I'm really meaning lignins, tannins, and condensed hydrocarbons. When we look at what's in the the coarser pores, we see things that are more biomolecule, more theoretically decomposable, lipids, carbohydrates, and proteins. And where I'm going to go through this talk, by the time I come to the end, you're going to see why I've completely relinquished the word recalcitrant, because there was a time when this group would have been considered the recalcitrant carbon. So we wanted to do an experiment that tested the effect of moisture extremes, really built on this observation we had in this one sandy soil, on carbon persistence and vulnerability, and the effect of antecedent drought and the effect of, you know, previous saturation, how that changes the microbes and what they're doing. So we have this experiment that we started that my team is calling the Three Soils Experiment, because we've selected three soils from around the country for this. At one point it was called the 3 a.m. experiment, because I truly woke up at 3 a.m. with the idea and realized that I didn't want to lose track of it, so I actually jotted it down, and finally I had to say, let's not call it the 3 a.m. experiment. It makes me sound like a drunk. So we have three soils that we focused on. We very carefully selected these to be very, very different soils. We actually have a soil from the Caribou Poker Creeks Research Watershed up in Alaska. You'll see that the three soils are from Alaska, Washington State, and near Orlando and Florida. And they have sharply different annual precipitations and potential evapotranspiration variances. So we just see some very different hydrodynamic conditions in them. The soil from CPCRW is a Gilmore silt loam. It's poorly to well-drained, and we're focused on the upland mineral soils that are adjacent to streams and wetlands that are vulnerable to hydrologic modifications. And these are particularly vulnerable to things that could change them through permafrost melting or precipitation events. We have a second soil that's from Washington State. We call it Secret River. It's a tributary that leads to a tidal wetland on the Columbia River. It's also an inceptazole dominated by Sitka spruce. These are poorly drained floodplains, but it is a tidal freshwater that features a really extensive network of interconnected underground channels that do fill and recede daily. Now, one thing about this is it's an upland marsh position, so it is likely as we go through climate change, some of these sites are more or less vulnerable to changes, really radical changes in water status. But we're more interested in these as model systems. One other thing about this soil you'll see is it's got significant iron staining and actions going on there. And then finally, the third soil is the one that the sandy soil that we've started off working on, and we've kind of continued as a thread for all of our work. It's a pine flatwood stand from the Disney Wilderness Preserve. It's a neon relocatable site just outside Orlando. It's the soil, as I mentioned, is very sandy. It has moderate to high levels of organic matter accumulation at the surface. One of the really interesting things about this, because this is part of the headwaters to the Everglades, there's a very strong below-ground groundwater rise pressure, so we've got a rather large deposit of organic matter at about 2 meters as well. So the question that this experiment sought to address is, how does drought versus saturation alter soil carbon mobilization and transformation? So we have four treatments that we're really looking at here. One was immediately bring the soils in, and there was no storage in these soils. We timed these so we could bring them in, and everything was handled fresh to start with. Immediately saturated these soils completely to enable the sampling of the pore water. So that's one thing we have to do to get these pore water samples, is we do need to start out with a saturated soil. It just allows the vacuum pressure to initiate. We also took another set of cores and held them at field moist conditions for about 30 days. And then we followed that by the rapid saturation and pore water sampling. And then we took another set of soils and we dried them down to constant weight in an environmentally controlled chamber. So sometimes that took about 2 months to get them down to constant weight. And then we held them at that continuous dry phase for 30 days to simulate the drought. And then we followed that with a very rapid saturation and pore water sampling. And then finally, when we brought those soil cores into the lab, we immediately saturated them and held them under these sort of flood-like conditions for 30 days and then sampled the pore water. We have five major analyses that we're exploring. One is water-soluble carbon. That's kind of a basic, you know, it comes off the pore water sampling as well as the whole soil. I'm looking at the pore water-soluble carbon by fraction. We're also using high-resolution mass spectrometry, so we're Fourier transform ion cyclotron resonance. I'll go into a little bit about that shortly. But then we're also doing full metagenomics on the soils and also transcriptomics. I'm not going to talk about the biological piece right now. I'm going to get into some of the reactions, but there's just so much data coming in so hard and so fast that I've had to distill this down to something that I can fit in this talk. So looking at the water-soluble organic carbon, when we look at this just across the board, the first is the northern soil, the Alaskan one, then Florida, and then the Washington State tidal freshwater. When we actually pool all of these together and run the statistics on them, we actually find that the time zero treatment and then overall the Alaska soil has the highest water-soluble organic carbon values, although you see when we do the internal comparisons, it's a little bit more variable. But we do see a much stronger influence in the quality of carbon by pore size domain, and we see that the fine pores have significantly more soil organic carbon, generally speaking, with a few variances here, and that drought seems to exert a fairly strong effect in this one particular soil here and also in the tidal freshwater. The sandy soil becomes really interesting as we go deeper into the soil, and I'm going to break this out a little bit more. When we actually now want to dissect out what's going on in these different pore size domains, so I really want you to think about for a moment, we're looking now here for the sampling that we're comparing, we're looking at pores greater than 300 microns, so great big behemoth pores with lots of aeration and lots of opportunity for activities, and then pores that are 6 to 20 microns in diameter. Now these are highly habitable pores, but they are, you know, still smaller. There's not going to be a whole lot of room for a whole lot of little microbial beasties to get in there and have a feast. Looking at the CPCRW soil, we see that drought increases the soil organic carbon in both pore size domains. So what we're thinking here is there's something causing sort of a solubilization of carbon under the conditions of drought that we don't really understand. We can speculate a lot about it, but I want to dig into that in terms of the chemistry that's going on in the soil. When we look at the Secret River soil, incubation alone was sufficient to increase soil organic carbon in pore waters. So what we see here is our time zero had fairly low concentrations of carbon in the pore waters, but just holding it field moist, saturation, or under drought conditions, we actually see increase in soluble carbon. So again, something just the act of sampling, bringing it into the lab, handling it, here has stimulated a solubilization of carbon. And finally, Disney Wilderness Preserve. The soil organic carbon in pore waters was relatively unaffected by incubation and treatment. And now this is actually, I'm going to dig into this a little bit more because we don't see any major treatment differences. The pore size domains look relatively similar. But there's actually a lot going on here. And we know the soil fairly well because this is the soil we developed these approaches with. And so we're digging into this one first. We have all of these soils lined up. They have got FTICR data on them. And we are still waiting on the transcripts. But the high-resolution mass spectrometry, FTICR, that we've gotten from access to EMSL has come back for some of the soils. And we can get a very detailed molecular description of the soil chemistry, and this allows us to discover chemical reactions that allow us to relate soil organic molecules. So we get molecular formulae, M over Z features coming off the FTICR. We can actually speculate and assign them different molecular formulae, or we can actually just map them and sort of allocate the M over Z features that map based on the H over C and O over C ratios. Can be assigned to lipids, carbohydrates, whatever. It's okay. And we can group them that way. And that was what I was showing you before when I was talking about the complex carbon, the simple carbon. We were grouping this that way. But there's actually a much more fun way to use these data, even though it gets a little bit more complicated, is we can actually use the very precise measurements this instrument yields to identify chemical pathways via mass transformations. So we can actually look for mass defects in these chemical chemical features and identify transamination reactions, demethylation reactions. Because this instrument, this mass spec, is so precise, sub-part per billion accuracy, we can really get these pathways out. And one of the other things we can do is we can take these pathways, identify them in terms of reactions, and map them back to the KEG database to infer what processes are going on with respect to carbon cycling. So when we go into this, based on those reactions, what we found was about 85 chemical processes could be inferred using this approach in the different pore size domains for this Disney Wilderness Preserve soil. When we actually look for where the statistical difference is, we actually only found 13 chemical processes that were significantly different, and they were all significantly higher in the macropores. And one of the things that became very interesting when we dug into this is the processes that we see that were increased in these macropores are dominated by amino acid-associated reactions. So it seems that they're in these larger pores is where a lot of this amino acid decomposition degradation is going on. There are a few other processes going on, ATP-type reactions, but that's not all that surprising. So this led us to ask, okay, is this a proximity issue? Is it just that those fine pores don't have as many microbes in them, so we're seeing more evidence of activity in those coarse pores? And so we took the soil pore waters that we had sampled from Disney Wilderness Preserve, different soil pores, pulled them out of the soil, and actually used that as the carbon substrate for an incubation with three different model organisms separately. So we used Streptomyces cellulosae, Salvibrio japonicus, and we actually used a fungus because they are important in soils, Trichoderma riesii. We filter sterilized these pore waters, and we used it as a growth substrate for these pure cultures in a very short-term incubation. We did measure the CO2 through all 8 days of the incubation, and we also measured the carbon content and the carbon profile, again using FTICR after the incubation as well. And what we found was the carbon that was extracted from the micropores, the solid lines, was actually, in all three cases, more rapidly and extensively metabolized to CO2 than the carbon that was associated, that was derived from the macropores. This was a little bit surprising to us, but it certainly suggests that proximity may be what's limiting the transformation of these carbon compounds, that it's not a case of the carbon that's in those fine pores can't be decomposed. It's just not close to the organisms that are decomposing it, because when we take this physical separation away completely, we actually do see a very nice decomposition potential of the carbon that we used to consider recalcitrant. So, kind of closing up, the eye of the needle, in my opinion, is a biological one, certainly, but I think there's also a very strong physical impact. I think it's very important that we consider water as being a connective material through soils, as well as being the reaction solvent for all of these reactions. Fine pores are physically protecting soil organic carbon from microbial decomposition. If we're looking at this just in terms of soil organic carbon persistence and vulnerability, I think it's a very important thing to consider. There's been a ton of work going the other direction in terms of how do mineral surfaces stabilize carbon, sorption. We saw some of Marcus Klaber's work alluded to this morning. I think that's really, really important. But I think it's very interesting to start thinking about how are the chemical conditions favoring desorption of this carbon and releasing it through that eye of the needle for processing and ultimately greenhouse gas emissions. So the chemical nature of CO2 does not inhibit decomposition if we take the proximity barrier away. And we also see when we're looking at sampling coming off native soils, natural soils, that decomposition is largely occurring in coarse pores. One of the things we are then moving on to that I can't show you right now because we're still waiting for the sequence data is some hypotheses about whether we see increased abundance of osmotolerance factors in microorganisms that have been subjected to drought versus perhaps an increase in motility factors or enzymes that are require diffusive properties for them to acquire carbon through that in soils that have been held at saturated. So we're trying to get this very large picture by using these three disconnected soils from around the country. We're hoping to find maybe some generalizable principles that we can use to inform models at a more meaningful way. This has been a huge study. It's ongoing. There's been a number of people that have helped out. Research was done in EMSL. Those beautiful images I started with were from Argonne National Lab. This is largely funded by the U.S. Department of Energy, the Terrestrial Ecosystem Sciences Program. And then I really do have to give a shout out because I've got really, everybody has the best darn team in soil science. But Tanya Roy Chowdhury has been a postdoc with me. She's just about to leave us for a new challenge at University of Maryland. Kathy Todd Brown remains at PNNL where she's doing some really wonderful microbial explicit modeling. Peyton Smith is still here, but very anxious to move on to new challenges. And then Sarah Fansler, who I have to give her a shout out, has been my right hand for 15 years and doesn't come to this meeting, but boy, she really should. I thank you for your attention and your patience with this weird timing thing.
Before we start, I again encourage you to move up and jump out the door. And with that, do you have any questions?
So why is it that the aromatic compounds are preserved in those narrow pores instead of all compounds? So if it's just a physical pore that keeps it separate from decomposition?
So the composition of those pores, of the carbon in those pore waters, is relative. So it means that we have a higher abundance. It's dominated by aromatics in those fine pores, not that it's exclusively aromatics in those fine pores. So it could entirely be that the aromatics that were in the large pores were actually more rapidly and extensively decomposed, leaving behind simpler compounds that we've always thought were the simple ones, easier to degrade. We're right now just about to start an experiment where we're going to take those pore waters and inoculate them into sort of a sterile blend of minerals just to see how they differentiate on their own.